y'all. Thanks for listening to Killer Queens.
Or KQ if you're nasty.
Welcome to the show where two 90s-loving country chicks gab about true crime and tell each other to talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. I'm Torella.
And I'm Tori.
And we're sisters who have always loved true crime and decided to turn that obsession into a show with a light take on the topic.
Kind of like diet true crime, it's all the flavor and fewer calories.
Now with our show, you'll get true crime, 90s nostalgia, and a few four-letter words sprinkled in.
Because I always say that Polly Pockets and true crime go together like peas and carrots.
Be sure to check out our case submission form on our website at killerqueenspodcast.com and follow us on social media and YouTube.
Now grab your Surge, your 3D Cool Ranch Doritos, and your kitten surprise, and let's get into the episode.
This episode contains discussion of child murder and extreme religion. Listener discretion is advised.
In late 2019, Kay Woodcock called local police and asked them to perform a welfare check on her 7-year-old grandson, JJ Vallow. She hadn't seen him in almost 2 months and couldn't get in touch with his mother or older sister. As investigators began to look into where JJ was, they found that his 16-year-old sister, Ty Lee Ryan, was also missing. Their mother, Lori Vallow, claimed that they were safe and happy, but refused to tell anyone where they were. Detectives continued to dig into the Vallow family and found a sickening story of extreme religion, demons, zombies, and murder. They found suspicious deaths that surrounded Lori, as well as her new husband, Chad Daybell. Unfortunately, no one could find JJ or Tylee. Were they really somewhere safe, or had they been victims of Lori and Chad's bizarre cult-like religion?
Hey, you guys, welcome to Killer Queens. If you've never been here before, we want to give you just a little information about how the show is set up and what it's meant to accomplish. If you have been here before, welcome back. You can just use that handy skip ahead feature here if you want to.
We want to give a message to friends and family of the victims. We know that there may be someone involved in the case who might listen one day, and we want you to know that our intention is to only bring awareness to this case. And while we do use personal stories in some instances and our own humor in order to tell the story in a way that listeners can relate, we have the utmost respect for victims and their families.
We created Killer Queens to be a place where we can have open discussions about cases just like you would with friends. We are not investigators. We use information that is available to the public, such as documentaries, case files, and media coverage. Using this information, we intend to tell the story of what happened in each case that we cover. Now, will you agree with our interpretations or conclusions of each case? Well, heck no.
Mm-mm. We each approach cases from different perspectives, life experiences, and beliefs that we already have in place. And sometimes these differences are slight, yet they can be wide enough to cause divide and upset some of those listening. We do our best to present the facts as we find them in our research, but we do bring our own perspectives to the case. We understand that you will too. We want you to know that this is a safe space to discuss differences and opinions in a civilized manner. Our style may not be your personal preference, and if that's the case, we know you'll be able to find one of the many other shows out there to tell the story the way you want to hear it. We can be grown-ups about it if you can.
Now, if we are your cup of tea and you want even more KQ, you can join our Patreon and get access to our entire catalog of episodes ad-free and access to bonus episodes too. And I'll give you just a little hint if you're an ad skipper, but you still want the deals that we have from our sponsors each week, you can scroll down to the show notes and see what coupons we have available for you right down there.
But you didn't hear it from us.
That's a pro tip, but I'll deny ever sharing it.
Right. So all that being said, let's get into the story.
Okay. So probably if you're watching this, you're somewhat familiar with this case. It was and is a huge case. I mean, we still have Chad Daybell's trial to go through. But man, when you get into it, it's just
outrageous.
Yeah, exactly. We do have, though, lots and lots and lots of thank yous before we get into this. This case was suggested by Paige Bryan. How do you say?
Bryson.
My goodness. Paige Bryson. How do you say this name?
Shercy.
Thank you. River. Kaylee Crawford. Bridget Powell.
Or Shersa, maybe? Shersa?
Both beautiful.
Yes.
Bridget Powell. Lee Cesarez. Whitney Rogers. Bailey Decker. Claire Rodriguez. Fancy britches. I like that. Lee Conan, Jessica Brazel, Virginia Grant, Andy Smith, Kaylee Harden, Lauren, Shariah, Mandy Marco.
Yeah.
Wow. This, I'm going to go out on a limb and say this is our highest requested case so far.
I would say so.
That's, yeah, that's a lot of names. And these are people that used our form online. So I'm sure other people have commented or messaged and suggested it. So this is like just the form submissions.
Absolutely. And we also have to thank Madison for writing it up.
Thank you. Okay, so let us begin. And this is a two-parter, by the way, guys. There's too much for one part. Sorry. And as always, if you are a patron at even the lowest level, doesn't matter what level you are going to get the audio of part two immediately, right away. So there you have it. Otherwise, part two is out next week. No big deal.
Yay!
Lori Noreen Cox was born on June 26, 1973 in Loma Linda, California, to Janice and Barry Cox. She was the third of four children with two older brothers, Alex and Adam, and then she had a younger sister, Summer. The entire Cox family was raised in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Lori's faith was very important to her, and her family recalls how she loved the Book of Mormon and quickly took to it. Like, even as a little girl, she loved it.
That's, I don't know the right word. I don't want to, impressive, but also like odd.
Yeah, in her case, odd.
Different.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, I don't know. As a kid, I liked Barbie and stuff. I don't know. I wasn't like, we weren't raised super religious, but still. But she definitely, like, it was one of those things that, like, out of all the children, she was the one that, like, was, as a child, quoting scripture and really studying it and stuff like that. And her siblings weren't necessarily that into it.
It's probably why Jesus loved the little children, all the children of the world, especially Lori.
Especially Lori, but especially Lori.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't worry, she'll just tell you that if you don't know. In 1992, shortly after graduating high school, Lori married her boyfriend, Nelson Yanes, but this marriage did not last long. In 1995, she married another man named William LaGoya. At 22 years old, Lori gave birth to her first child, a son named Colby. Colby remembered that Lori's marriage to his father was toxic, and she didn't want her son to grow up that way, so they left in 1998. In 2001, Lori married her third husband, Joseph Anthony Ryan Jr., and it seemed like everything was turning around for Lori and Colby at this point. Joe was a great husband and father, and even legally adopted Colby. On September 24th, 2002, Lori gave birth to the couple's first child, a daughter named Tylee Ashlyn Rylan.
No.
Oh, I said Rylan. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I'm used to saying Rylan because I have a friend whose child's name is Rylan. So I just stuck that right in there, didn't I? There's a lot of L's too.
Yeah.
Tylee Ashlyn Ryan. Sorry. Born just a day after Lori's sister Summer, Tylee was referred to by her aunt as her almost birthday twinner. I had an almost birthday twinner too with our cousin's daughter. She was born a day before my birthday. So
yes.
I was like, can you hold her in another 11 hours? Like, is it that much to ask?
Like, and apparently it was. Yeah.
Yeah, it was. It was. Yeah. Summer described Tylee as a tiny baby, barely over 5 pounds at birth. The little girl with blue eyes and golden hair seemed to do everything early, walking, talking, reading. Tylee was excited to do everything. It didn't take long for Tylee to have her big brother Colby wrapped right around her little finger. Oh. They were best friends, despite Colby being about 6 or 7 years older. Her Aunt Summer told stories about how Tylee always wanted to be a big girl. When Lori had a small hair salon built into her house and took clients, Tylee would often be found in her mother's salon chair, getting her hair styled like the big girls. Ugh.
Ooh.
As a child, Tylee was diagnosed with the disease pancreatitis. This is inflammation of the pancreas. She was admitted to the hospital at least 7 times during severe flare-ups, but Lori was always there, being her daughter's voice when she was in pain, making sure that she was being taken care of. Lori helped her with school to make sure she didn't fall behind. She scheduled visits from friends and had fun things to keep her occupied until she was released from the hospital. And by all accounts, even Colby and family members and everybody, they were like, Lori was a fantastic mother.
Mm-hmm.
Like, super engaged, super involved.
Well, you know, like, okay, the evil lives here. And it's like, but there were signs. There weren't many signs at this point. Like,
It seemed, yeah, it seemed like, you know, she was just a really engaged and loving mother. I mean, she did everything she could for these kids at this time. That just makes it like you said, if you see the signs coming up, I'm not saying it's none of this is easy in any way, shape, or form, but it's almost like, okay, well, now that I look back on it, you know, whatever the case is. But in this case, it's just, they're so blindsided. Like,
well, and I know from, I don't know, from experience, obviously I've never dealt with anything like this, but I will say that looking back on things like, you know, life experiences or whatever, I have definitely been like, man, if I had just known earlier, and I don't know what I would have done, but it kind of feels like you could have guarded your heart a little bit more. Like maybe, you know.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like they just, love of a mother is supposed to be the safest place in the whole world for you. Yeah. Mm. Tylee was great in school, even eventually testing out of high school because she was college ready in every single subject. Wow. She was an excellent artist. She sang, danced, drew. She did calligraphy. She was a photographer.
God.
This girl is like 16 years old at this time. Like,
So talented.
I know. One of her favorite subjects to photograph later in life was her younger brother. Her aunt described her as, quote, funny, kind, but could also be bitingly sarcastic. She really came into her own when she turned 16. So Tylee had her first job working at her uncle's chiropractic office, which helped her develop a great interest in physical therapy and working with patients. One of her other passions was her faith. Like Lori, she grew up in the LDS church. She was a part of their young women's program and was an advocate for others to join the church. Tylee's aunt later described her by saying, quote, Tylee was sensitive, thoughtful, considerate, humble, generous, caring, and tough. She would have been the best mother as she loved children. Oh, that's just so sad. Her favorite color was a bright blue. She called it the color of Hawaii. Her favorite dessert was a no-bake cheesecake. Tylee loved the shows The Office, Friends, The Bachelor, and others. She loved music. She loved her friends and had so many fun times with them. So, after Tylee was born, Lori ended up entering the Miss Texas pageant. And she even went on Wheel of Fortune explaining that God had told her that she was meant to be on the show. Okay. And she did enter the Miss Texas thing. And if you watch, there's like a Netflix thing on this. There's a bajillion datelines. I mean, they were putting them out as the case was developing and like all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of information out there on this case. You can see her entry. I don't know, part of what she did with the pageant and stuff like that. There was one question that they asked her, which is just so chilling now. But there was one question that they asked her and they're like, I don't know what the question was, but she's answering it. It's like, what's important to you or something like that. She's like, I want to be a great mother, a great wife. You know, I try to make sure I have time to exercise and make sure I have time for my faith. And like, I'm paraphrasing, but she's talking about keeping up with everything and kids and blah, 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 okay, all that stuff. And then she says, I'm basically a ticking time bomb.
Oh my
God. Yikes.
Like she's a walking red flag and she has been. Cause like once you know, you like hindsight, right? But watching her, it's like she's not really trying to be slick, but she's so charismatic and
she's so charismatic.
Flirty and something. Like it works in her favor and people are like, oh, really? And they just fall right into it.
And she's conventionally attractive. Like we're going to see that in this case time and time again where police officers are just mesmerized with her and they're just super flirty back with her and they just believe everything that she says.
Exactly.
Like it's, But her saying she was a ticking time bomb. Now, do plenty of people say that if they've got a super busy schedule and blah, blah, blah? I'm sure they do.
Yeah.
But in this case, in hindsight, it is chilling. Back at home, it seemed like her marriage was headed for the same fate that her two previous ones had. Colby said that He initially loved having Joe as his father, but it had gotten to a point where it seemed like every single thing that Colby did annoyed Joe to no end. And, you know, he said, I don't know if it was just like, you know, little boy stuff. Cause I know that age around 7, 8, 9, I don't know how long it lasts. Boys are doing, you know, they're picking, they're whatever. Like my son will do something and he'll be like, was that funny? Like they're trying to learn what's funny. They're trying to test boundaries, like all these things. So there are things that they can do that like as an adult, you're like, okay, that's annoying. Quit doing that. But like, you know, he's like, I don't know if it was just little kid stuff I was doing. Like, I don't know what it was. But he ended up becoming physically abusive towards Colby. Reportedly, he was also physically abusive towards Lori. In 2005, she took Colby and Tylee and left Joe. She filed for divorce. After they were out of the home, though, Colby told his mother that Joe had also been sexually abusing him. A therapist later revealed that Tylee confided that Joe had also sexually abused her. Just heartbreaking. And if you watch the Netflix, what is it called? Sins of Our Mother. Mm-hmm. Joe's sister is actually in it. And she corroborates these things. I mean, not saying that we wouldn't believe them, but, you know, you've got members of his family saying,
yeah,
yep, I think that's what was happening. Around this time is when Lori became even more involved with the church. She reportedly went to her bishop and told him that she was either going to turn her life to the temple or she was going to murder Joe for what he had done. And Colby said that his mother often talked about wanting Joe dead, horrified at what he'd done to her children. And like in this situation, you can understand that, you know?
Definitely.
I might say something similar, something like that happened to my child. Like,
yeah, of course.
But man,
we know too much.
We know too much.
Yeah.
And Lori's brother, Alex, was also talking about wanting Joe dead. He was doing stand-up comedy at this point, which would include stories about where, like, he would talk about how he had tased Joe with a stun gun.
Which is a felony in Texas.
Yes. I mean, he's just, again, it's like, okay, this is a stand-up comedian. He's probably making all this shit up, but like then...
But he would preface it. He would be like, this is a true story. Seriously. And then he would say it. But it's like, yeah. That can't be true.
I know. Oh, you got to feel like really bad for the people that were like in the audience and being like, oh my God, I thought he was joking still. And like, I laughed at that. And,
exactly.
Oh my gosh. So Joe and Lori fought over custody of Tylee, but ultimately Lori was rewarded full custody. In 2006, Lori met a man named Charles Vallow through a client at her salon. And everybody said they seemed perfect together. Charles was a businessman. He was financially secure. Lori seemed to really love him. They got married and Charles joined the LDS church, wanting to join his new wife in what she enjoyed so much. In 2013, Lori and Charles adopted my goodness, there's an X in there and now I can't
really threw you for a fucking loop.
Sure did. Joshua Jackson Vallow, referred to by friends and family as JJ. JJ was the biological grandchild of Charles's sister, Kay. JJ's biological parents were reportedly unable to take care of him, so his grandparents cared for him for the first 10 months of his life, but he was ultimately legally adopted by Lori and Charles. And Kay and her husband felt that that would just be better for JJ. They were younger. It would give him kind of a more normal life. And then they'd still be able, obviously, to
be in
have a
life.
Relationship with him. Yeah. JJ had autism and Lori was said to have been a very patient mother and loved having JJ as her son. While the entire family was excited for JJ to join them, it was difficult to tell who was most excited, his new brother, Colby, or his new sister, Tylee. These kids had such a sweet relationship with each other.
I know.
Oh my gosh. Both siblings were ecstatic to have a younger brother. Tylee helped care for JJ, and she would even sometimes like jokingly refer to him as her son. She's like, this is my son. And like, I don't know, it's just really sweet.
Yeah.
Her love and caring for others was obvious, and she always made sure that her little brother was safe. JJ was a goofy kid who seemed to always have a smile on his face. He loved Willie Nelson and the song We Will Rock You by Queen. When visiting with his grandfather, Larry Woodcock, JJ could often be found singing songs on a microphone with him, and he'd even perform concerts for his stuffed animals at home. Sweet baby.
Angel, I know. Lori's involvement with the church had gotten more intense after her divorce from Joe. There were pictures throughout their house of temples, and she was often talking about what spirits had told her, what instructions and directions they'd given her. In December of 2014, Lori told her family that a spirit instructed her to move to Kauai, Hawaii. It feels very redundant, but okay. The entire family packed up and moved to the Hawaiian island. The children absolutely loved living in Hawaii, of course. I mean, like, it's paradise, right? Gosh,
I wish God would tell me to move to Hawaii.
I know. I've seen Rip Girls on the DCOM. Disney Channel original movie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I want to go to there. I've seen Johnny Tsunami before he goes to snowboarding.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Not when he's one. A surfer. Yes. Yeah. But anyway, Lori joined their local LDS church and quickly made friends. April Raymond, one of her closest friends in Kauai, remembered that, you know, she thought Lori and Charles had the perfect marriage. They had the perfect family. But once they started hanging out, she figured out that Lori complained a lot about Charles. And apparently, Lori believed that Charles wasn't her spiritual equal. Her religious beliefs had become more extreme, and much of her time was spent either at the church or talking about the spirits and their communications. She told her friends and family that angels were communicating with her. And she once said, quote, "I no longer need to sleep very much because I'm woken up constantly by angels giving me instructions on things I can do to help further the Father's work."
Mm-hmm. And so this would be the point in her life where but there were signs. This is when the family is starting to be like, oh, I don't know. Because, I mean, she's saying, I don't need to sleep. Everybody needs to sleep.
Well, absolutely. Like, and that's like, I feel like those are signs of a mental break.
Yes. Yes. We've covered other cases where this is what happens.
Uh-huh. You get super religious sometimes, but we've covered cases that they have. You don't sleep a lot. Your entire life is devoted to, let's use Lori's phrasing, the Father's work. Like, it's just, I don't know. It's right. A slippery slope. I don't know.
And then you start deeming people
less than, good, bad, not your spiritual. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. In 2017, the Vallow family moved out of Hawaii and back to Chandler, Arizona. I feel like that would be a culture shock. Even if you've only been there if I went for 2 weeks, I'd be like, what the hell? Where are the palm trees?
Yeah, I don't live anywhere else anymore. Sorry.
No. Colby, Tylee, and JJ were all sad to leave the island, understandably so. But not long after returning to Arizona, Colby reconnected with an old high school friend, or a school friend, excuse me, named Kelsey. The two began dating, and it quickly became serious. Colby began attending Kelsey's Christian church with her, which absolutely infuriated Lori. It seemed as though Lori thought Kelsey was taking her son away from her. After Colby and Kelsey got engaged, the animosity from Lori seemed to get even worse. And it was as though she felt like she had to compete with Kelsey for Colby's love.
Not normal. You're the mom, not the girlfriend. Why do we have to explain this to you?
Woo! Colby recalled his mother saying strange things, even once telling Kelsey that Jesus loved Kelsey, but he loved Lori more.
And that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Jesus loved the little children, all the children of the world, especially Lori Vallow.
Yeah. Yeah. And that came directly from the big man upstairs. He was like, Lori, I love Kelsey. Fine. She's fine. She's okay. Yeah, she's whatever. Yeah. I love you the most. Tell Kelsey that I said this. It's like God handed Lori a note to pass to Kelsey. Like,
exactly. Okay. So ridiculous. And also very convenient. Like, oh my me. Like, if I heard voices from God, I'm pretty sure the voices that I would want to hear are, Tori, you're killing it.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing great.
Mm-hmm. Love you the
and
most.
Also, yeah. You're my favorite.
Yeah.
Love you. Bye. So at the wedding, Tylee was noticeably absent. So the family were taking family photos and Colby and Kelsey were like, well, where the hell is Tylee? Like, she's supposed to be here. And Lori was like, oh, she's on a ski trip.
Squeeze so me?
Yeah, in my experience, I've only had the one wedding, but it's not something that you throw together last minute, typically. So sometimes you have to work around, I don't know, football games. Sometimes you can say, oh, I was going to go out of town or I have a vacation, but I'm going to move that because I've got a year, 6 months, whatever amount of time to be like, I have to go to this wedding, you know?
Mm-hmm. And my sibling's wedding, like, you yes! know, for a fact with how close they were, that Tylee would have wanted to be at that wedding.
She would have never, ever missed unless she was forced to.
Yeah.
Exactly. So after the wedding, things changed even more so with Lori. She became much more focused on the end times. Again, a very, very clear sign of a psychological break. And she'd also become extremely engrossed in the writings of a man named Chad Daybell, later described as a, quote, apocalyptic writer.
Hmm. Okay. Now we have to talk about Chad Daybell.
I don't want to. Can we not?
I know, right? Forget Chad Daybell. Okay.
See, and the hardest thing for me is, personally, when you say his name, I think I envision him. And I hate that fucking guy.
Do you remember when we first started the show? This is one of our back catalog episodes, which if you want our first 44, you can go to killerqueens.link/OG and get them. But for free. But there was one where we talked about a guy. Yikes, I'm forgetting his name now. Todd Kohlhepp. And we were talking about him and we said, like, go to our Instagram and find this post and type woof, because he just looked like a derpy derp. Like, we hated him, hated his face and everything. And I remember seeing those comments come in, and like every once in a while we'll get a notification and it'll just say woof. And I'm like, I know which post that's on. It's so funny, but
I love it.
We can do the same thing. You can woof on Chad Daybell. Woof.
Yeah. Woof, goon, whatever you disgust.
Derpity derp derp.
Yeah. Well, okay, listen, I'm going to give hate where hate is due. Okay. I'm going to do it. This guy is a piece of shit human being. So I'm going to say that he dresses real stupid. He's not at all attractive. Not even the least bit.
Not even a little, no.
Mm-mm. I'm not seeing what she, like, I'm not smelling what The Rock is cooking in this situation. I'll just say that right now.
No, yeah. Absolutely not.
But keep going.
Yeah. Okay. So Chad Daybell grew up in Utah in a family that was heavily involved with the LDS Church. He attended Brigham Young University, graduating with a degree in journalism in 1992. He started his own publishing company called Spring Creek Book Company in 2004, along with his wife, Tammy, and they had 5 children together. Chad's books were becoming more and more well-known within the Mormon community, but he still had to work several jobs to help support his family. Another writer said that in 2014, she began to notice a change in Chad's writing. He published a total of 25 books.
That's so many books.
Writing about 2 near-death experiences, as well as what he believed would be the world's apocalypse and second coming of Jesus Christ.
I feel like that the subject matter that we're talking about, 2 near-death experiences, and the second coming of Jesus Christ and the world apocalypse, right? The extent of my knowledge on those things, now I haven't lived through 2 near-death experiences, thank goodness, but 2 book stops. How do you keep on with that?
Yeah, how do you squeeze 25 books out of that?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I don't know. His writings became more and more outlandish, which brought him an entirely new set of readers and supporters. And we know that there is a market for this kind of stuff. And when we covered, what was that? Devil You Know.
Yeah. Oh, Sherry Shriner.
Her name was Sherry Shriner. Yeah. Like, she had people that still consume her content. Like, it just, it's almost like the more outlandish it is, the more people get sucked into it, which is...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Chad said that after having his two near-death experiences, he was able to be in two different worlds at once. Okay? Like heaven and not heaven. Okay? On his official website, Chad's book, Living on the Edge of Heaven, describes his experiences, quote, "When Chad Daybell was 17 years old, he had a near-death experience while cliff jumping. He crossed into another dimension and realized there was a world beyond this one. A second near-death experience in his early 20s was much more in-depth. He was hit by a monstrous wave at La Jolla Cove in California. While his body was being tossed by the wave, his spirit was visiting with his grandfather, who showed him future events involving his still unborn children. This accident caused his veil that separates mortal life from the spirit world to stay partially open. So he often feels as if he has a foot in both worlds."
See, I'm not getting that. Two near-death experiences, but surviving. Hats off to you. That's a tough, tough break. One could argue, though, it's kind of Final Destination-y. Like, it's maybe it's just your fucking time. Like, 17 in the early 20s, that's what, 5 years tops?
Mm-hmm.
Like, damn. Like, I wonder, why won't you die?
I know. Like, I wonder what the world would be like. What the situation, like, would Lori still, you know?
I don't know. She was exhibiting a lot
person.
Of
yeah.
signs.
Yeah. She was getting really,
I think if she hadn't found Chad, she would have found like a Charles Manson, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Probably. You're right. So Lori, of course, became one of the biggest supporters of Chad's writing. She fully believed what he wrote about the end times coming, his extreme religious views. Lori began preparing for the end of the world. She started stocking up on food, tents, other supplies. Her brother Alex seemed to support his sister and her beliefs, and he was also heavily involved with the LDS church.
Fucking Alex, man. I know we're going to talk about it, but like, I have the feelings.
Mm-hmm. Lori started a podcast with another church member, Melanie Gibb. The podcast was called Feel the Fire and was part of the Preparing a People podcast network.
Just really, really quickly.
The PPP.
Well, yes. of course.
Oh, no, the PP, Preparing a People.
PP. No. Podcast.
Oh, podcast. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Hearing parts of their podcast, because if you watch Sins of Our Mother, you will hear it, but it reminds me so much of, shit.
Shweaty
Why?
Bones.
Yes!
Yes, that's exactly what I thought too, listening to it, because they're like, hi, welcome to Feel the Fire.
It's our Hello there.
Podcast.
It's so great to hear from you.
Yeah, it's, can you, like, hi, we have Melanie on. Hi, Melanie.
Hi there, Lori. So great Hi, to be me. Here. Yeah, it's weird. And then they're like, oh, we have a special treat for you guys today. Here comes Chad Daybell. Like, it's just so, it's, I was like, sweaty balls.
Yes, exactly. It is exactly like that. So Preparing a People was a group formed by the people of the LDS Church. However, it was later said to not be officially affiliated with the church at all. The name was created to reference people readying themselves for the second coming of Jesus Christ. An article was later published on the Faithful Answers Informed Responses for the LDS Church website said that the Preparing a People group was heavily focused on, quote, sensationalism rather than doctrine. It summarized the group's beliefs and teachings by saying, quote, its teachings were on the fringe of the church's beliefs or an outright violation of church teachings. You got to think LDS is like, nah, get out of here. Don't act like we know each other. Please don't act like we know each other.
It's got to be pretty outlandish for the LDS church to say, and this is based off of Murder by Mormons. That's the extent of my knowledge and peripheral other things, I guess, that I've watched. But like, isn't there some kind of like salamander stuff going on? Like it's...
Oh, yeah. I don't remember. Something like that. Yeah. I know. They're like, please don't, like, no, we're not friends. Please don't do that.
Yeah.
In 2018, Lori finally met Chad in person at a Preparing a People conference. He was speaking at the conference, and while he was selling his books afterwards, Lori went up to speak to him. The two immediately connected. Not only did they connect, you guys, they believed that they had already been married in past lives. Like, immediately, they're like, oh my gosh, it's so nice to finally meet you in person. We've been married in past lives. And then the other one's like, I know, right? I know.
Like, right? Oh, you're okay. The person my alimony's been going to. Like, I don't... What
right,
what
yeah.
What are you like, doing?
Okay.
Could you imagine, like, that would be a surefire way for me to, like, have a Tory-shaped hole in the wall. If somebody was like, we've been married before. I'm like, bye! Like...
I know. Yeah. And she was just like, oh, yeah.
Wanna
and
be keep on my in podcast?
Mind, they're both married at this point. Two people in this life right
and
now.
And have children with their spouses.
Yes. So Chad started guest starring on Lori's podcast. They were talking about the impending apocalypse, all the things. So remember, Lori is living in Arizona with her husband and children. Chad is living in Idaho with his wife and children. And they were in constant communications. They each had special cell phones that were just to contact one another. But don't say that they have a relationship. They are not having an affair. Don't say that.
They're friends, and sometimes they only just met.
Oh, yeah, exactly. They don't even have each other's phone numbers. Anyway. Yeah. Lori's beliefs move from extreme to fantastical, as Chad explained that the apocalypse was coming and that only the righteous would survive. He said that Rexburg, Idaho, would become the new Jerusalem. This also happens to be where he already lives. So that's helpful.
Again, convenient.
The two believe that there were zombies walking around Earth that had demons possessing them. And these demons had already possessed many of their loved ones.
Dude, it's exactly Sherry Schreiner.
Mm-hmm. He also explained how he determined if someone was a mortal or a demon in a text to Lori. Quote, anyway, this is the chart that checks what percentage of mortals are still in their body. It worked for my friend's wife who died, my neighbor, George Bush, Stanley, etc. I kind of forgot about it because we've been dealing with zombies and demonic entities. But like now I remember. This really is Sherry Schreiner, because didn't she say she called people like lizards or whatever? Wasn't it like lizard people or something? And she would talk about celebrities. Lady Gaga, she
was
going to
say Lady Gaga. I think Taylor Swift was one as well.
Don't talk about Taylor Swift.
Okay, I'm sorry though. Like,
no, Sherry.
There was a serpent and it would go down and wrap around your vocal cords.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And the only way to rid them was to kill him.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, same situation here, isn't it?
That's what I'm saying.
Except the vocal cords specifically, but yeah, pretty but much. Still,
yeah. It's zombies. And you know what? I understand that only the, I don't know, righteous will survive. But I heard that a country boy can survive.
And that's just facts.
I know. Charles had noticed the drastic shift in his wife's behavior, of course, because he's living with her, and had become increasingly scared for his safety and for the safety of Tylee and JJ. Lori told one of her friends that Charles was already dead and that his body had been taken over by the spirit of a demon named Ned Schneider, and that they were just waiting for the demon to die. Why you gotta bring Ned into this? Like, what did Ned do? Who
also, the fuck is Ned? Yeah, leave Ned out of this, but... Like, also, if you're saying, I'm just waiting for the demon that is inhabiting my husband's spirit to die. Follow-up question. How is the spirit going to die, but your husband survived it? Like, that feels like we're talking about murder.
Yeah. Lori told her family, including Colby, that she'd found out that Charles had been cheating on her for years, but there was absolutely no evidence of this. She painted a picture of a marriage that was being destroyed by Charles while he tried to call and email Lori's family explaining that she was acting erratically and threatening him, and they refused to believe it. The entire Cox family cut him off at Lori's request.
Well, and this is somebody who knows their family is going to trust her. Mm-hmm. And like, you can argue she's going through a psychological break because it definitely seems like she's no longer living in this reality.
Sure.
But at the same time, she chose to lie about this situation to make Charles look bad and to give them a reason. They need a reason to just not talk to him, because if he gets through to them, they might believe what he's saying or whatever. She knows it's not what happened. It's just very interesting how calculating that was.
I was going to say, exactly. Yeah, like that's what determines, in my opinion, and I don't know, it seems like it doesn't always happen in everybody's opinion, but like that's what determines premeditation versus a spur of the moment kind of thing, or whether she's sane or not. Obviously, if she is making moves to try to either cover her tracks or get people on her side or whatever, if she was completely incapable of standing trial due to insanity, I don't think that she would have gone to the lengths that she did, which of course we'll get into, but
right,
she would not have gone to the lengths. Yes. Mm-hmm. And to lie, she would be telling her honest to God truth, which is crazier than a shithouse rat, but yeah. She wouldn't think it was crazy.
Right, because she thinks it's legit and she thinks it's real. And like, you think of Andrea Yates, who...
I was gonna say that.
Yeah, just straight up was like, yeah,
I did that
to save them. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's not what Lori does.
Not even a little bit. I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm getting worked up. I'm starting to sweat a little bit. On January 20th, 2019, when Charles attempted to return from a business trip in Houston, he found that his return ticket had been canceled. And when he finally made it back to Arizona, Charles learned that his truck had been removed from the airport parking lot. All of his belongings, including his clothing down to his underwear and his computer, had been removed from the family home. Charles calls the police and tells them that all of his stuff is gone, and he thought that his wife had lost her mind. Charles called the police to tell him that all of his things were gone and that he couldn't get in touch with either of his children. And he explained to the officers that he thought that his wife had lost her mind and that she and her brother, Alex, were deeply involved in the LDS church and that Lori thought that she was being resurrected. He told them that she'd emptied their bank account and threatened to kill him. And Charles tried to explain how Lori believed that he was no longer Charles, but a demon named Ned. And you got to think, I mean, poor Charles, like, this is his reality, but you got to think, like, whoever he's talking to is like,
okay. Crazy. Yeah, exactly. Like, exactly. Because if you are telling people this is what she believes, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Yes. And so they're like, they don't believe him.
No.
Which is so sad.
God, it's so sad. Yes. And so he calls the police. There's body cam footage of this entire interaction, and you can see, I mean, he's so sweet. I don't care what Lori said about Charles. I love Charles, and he was sweet, and he was a Southern man, and I love a good Southern man, but you can see the desperation, but he's also being so kind. He's like, okay, thank you. Like, okay, all right. Mm-hmm. You know, but you can tell he's like,
and he,
I don't know what to do.
And he also doesn't want to speak badly of her. He's like, I hate to say this, but she's losing her mind. Like, there's something going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not getting anywhere. Nobody believes him.
So sad. God, it's so sad. So Lori ended up reporting to the police station the next day with Tylee to explain what had happened. She told officers that while Charles had still been in Houston, they'd gotten into an argument over the phone about his reported infidelity. Again, no evidence of that. Lori said that she told Charles that when he arrived home, that everything would be gone and that she'd be taking the kids to spend the night in a hotel. Officers who were clearly, I mean, this is where they are like enamored by her. They're like, oh my God, she looked at me. Like, it's gross. But
yeah, she's like, she's being so like casual and flirty and
coquettish.
Yeah. And like, she's like, oh, well, yeah. I mean, I was upset about my lip gloss. Like, you know,
and they're like
yeah. And they're like, I mean, you seem really normal to me. Okay. This all seems fine. But she admits to taking his truck and moving it, canceling his flight, getting rid of all of his belongings, emptying the bank account. Like, she admits to all of these things. And they're just like, I mean, sounds like he had it coming. I don't know.
Yes. And they wanted, so they, the officers explained that Charles had filed an order to get, have her evaluated at a mental health facility. And they were like, look, it probably would be better if you just go ahead and go. But if you really don't want to go, you know, officers are going to come to your door. If they knock, just don't answer. Just talk to them through the door. Just don't go outside.
Yeah. He's like, we won't bust your door down. So if you just don't want to go, then just don't open the door.
Yeah.
How irresponsible is that?
I know.
Dangerous.
I cannot imagine what they're thinking, because she's got beer flavored nipples, and he, you know, whoever she's talked to that like fell for her siren song got tainted by her octopus ink. I can't imagine how they would feel now, because I would feel like a bag of dicks. And if I was like, dude, that guy got me swooning. And then he went on to kill, you know, whatever. I don't know. It's just. Yeah,
and they should. And honestly, there should be. I mean, you can't just bend the law because somebody's pretty. Well, I mean, absolutely. Come on. My gosh.
Exactly. Thank God I'm not more evil, because I am gorgeous.
I know.
I can get away with anything. I know.
Exactly. Hey, you guys. It's us again.
Yay. It's us.
We threw you for a loop on this one. So we know that a lot of you have been asking, like, WTF, where are episodes 1 through 44? And guess what? Now you can have them.
So let's just remember, though, we need you to take a little caution here. We didn't know exactly what we were doing back then. And we started this podcast as just a fun thing to do as sisters. We had no idea that it would grow into this super awesome club with you guys. So what we're saying is the audio wasn't super amazing, but the content is 100% us. Just being us and talking about some true crime with 90s flair.
Okay, so here are the details. You'll be able to access our what we're calling OG episodes in your favorite podcast app through a private and custom RSS feed link. So to grab that, head over to killerqueens.link/OG and snag episodes 1 through 44 today. That's killerqueens.link/OG.
It seemed pretty clear that the officers thought that Charles was acting strangely. He's the one who is just being crazy. So after this incident, Charles started living in Houston, visiting his children back at home, Lori's home in Arizona weekly. In late June of 2019, Charles confronted Lori about her relationship with Chad, and he threatened to tell Chad's wife, Tammy, about it if Lori didn't tell her herself. Lori's older or other brother, Adam, was one of the only family members who took Charles's claim seriously and was trying to help stage some sort of intervention for her. But despite everything going on between Charles and Lori, it was clear that he still cared for her and wanted his children to have their mother back. Which is so sad. I mean, like,
so sad.
After everything, he was still a good man.
Mm-hmm. On July 11th, 2019, at 7:35 a.m., Charles went to pick up JJ from the house in Arizona. When he arrived, he texted his brother-in-law, Adam, and told him that Alex was at the house. It was later found that Lori had texted Alex earlier in the week, asking him to, quote, stand by for her protection. She also thanked him for supporting her and that it was, quote, all coming to a head this week.
Again, premeditation.
Mm-hmm. Also at the home were Lori, 7-year-old JJ, and 17-year-old Tylee. At 8:32 a.m., Alex Cox placed a 911 call and told responders that he'd gotten in a fight with his brother-in-law and shot him in self-defense. When the dispatcher asked if he wanted to start CPR, Alex said, no, thank you. He actually said, no, I don't know how to do that. And she's like, I will walk you through it. But he literally was like, no, thanks. Yeah. Thank you for asking. No, I would not like to do that. Thank you. So the dispatcher gave Alex instructions for performing CPR, which he said that he was doing. First responders arrived on scene shortly after the 911 call was made and pronounced Charles dead. He was lying on the floor with 2 gunshot wounds to the chest. The gun was found in the front bedroom next to a gun case. Alex told police that Charles had been at the house for about 20 minutes and they'd been arguing about Lori. He said Charles had gotten physical with Lori that morning. Ty Lee had come out with a baseball bat to try to separate them, but Charles had taken the bat away from her. After Alex separated them, Lori left the home with Ty Lee and JJ. After that, Alex says Charles hit him in the back of the head with a baseball bat. So he had gone and grabbed his gun from the case. Alex said he told Charles to put the bat down, but that Charles had charged at him with the bat, so Alex shot him. Officers did note a small laceration on the back of Alex's head, but Charles is a fit guy, strong, I would think. Mm-hmm. He had this like teeny little laceration. I just feel like if Charles had knocked him in the back of the head with a baseball bat,
would have caused more of a boo-boo.
We'd be looking at a little bit more than that.
Well, and also, this is the classic case of bringing a bat to a gunfight. Like, I understand that somebody can 100% be murdered by a metal baseball bat. Like, I'm not saying that at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seems extreme force.
Mm-hmm. And we've got two gunshots. When one in the chest surely would have incapacitated him.
One in the fucking kneecap would have, you know what I mean? Like,
right. Exactly.
If the goal is to get him to quit charging you, there are other means.
Exactly. While police were processing the scene and talking to Alex, Lori pulled up on scene with Ty Lee. Body cam footage shows Lori waiting nearby, undisturbed, having a regular morning. She asks nobody if Charles is okay, anything like that. She was cooperative. She did answer questions, and she told the police that she had asked Alex to stay there the night before because she was scared Charles was going to come over and cause trouble for her or hurt her in some way. And she literally says, like, the officer is like, how long have you guys lived here? And she's like, oh gosh, just a couple weeks or days or something like that. And she's like, I know. I'm like, oh, sorry, neighbors. Hi. Like, sorry, neighbors. My husband just got murdered in the house. She's laughing about it.
Yeah. Sorry, we're causing such a commotion. Mm-hmm.
And the officers eat it
up. Yes. They're like, what a sweet and interesting lady.
This poor woman's husband just died. Can't rule out nervous laughter. Like, any other situation, they would have looked into this at all. They didn't look into it at all. But that would have been a red flag for them, and it wasn't. They were just like, she's so funny. Oh my gosh.
Yep.
Poor Lori has to be embarrassed that her husband was just shot and killed in the house in front of her new neighbors. I feel so bad for her. Like, come on. So Ty Lee told the officers that she'd brought the bat out just to kind of separate Charles and Lori, and that she'd really just poked Charles with it. Sorry. Lori said that she had heard the gunshots, but hadn't seen Alex actually shoot Charles. Then she saw Charles on the ground and said that she just went into mom mode. Like, I have to get the kids out of here. I got to get them to school, all that. After leaving, Alex called Lori and asked, was she taking JJ to school? And she said, yes, and go ahead and call 911. So as investigators looked more into exactly what happened, they found that at 7:49 a.m., Lori left the home. Listen to this. Okay. If she did leave and say, I got to get the kids out of here, they don't need to see this, all that kind of stuff. Understandable.
Yeah.
I would have expected her to leave in her own vehicle.
100%.
Whatever it is that she brings the kids to school in every day. What does she leave in? Charles's rental car.
Like, one would think, if you have no idea how the outcome of that altercation is going to go, Charles, you would think, would be leaving in that rental car.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's you're not like, it, oh, right? Well, he's going to be dead by the end of this, so I'll just go ahead and take it. He won't need it anymore. Like, that's so,
exactly.
So bizarre.
That is bizarre. And that raised no red flags to this police department. They weren't like, wait a second, why would you take his rental car? Mm-hmm. And she doesn't just, so she says she's heard gunshots and she leaves in his rental car, which oh my gosh. Then she takes the kids through the drive-thru at Burger King. She drops JJ off at school, and then she takes Ty Lee to Walgreens to buy flip-flops, and then they go back home.
Hmm.
Why? That is just killing time is what that is. What stops can we make that make no freaking sense that are just going to waste time so I can come back and clearly not have been there when the commotion was all happening.
Oh, absolutely. I feel kind of stupid. I didn't know that Burger King had like a breakfast menu. Is that like,
I think everybody does now.
Oh, okay.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, even Taco Bell does, so I figure.
Oh, true. Yeah.
Oh, you knew Burger King. You've had Burger King's breakfast, I think. Croissant.
Holy shit, I totally have. Yes,
croissant. Sandwich. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's been a long time, though.
Long time. Yeah. So the police report that night indicated that it was found to be a self-defense shooting. All of it checks out here. Alex was interviewed, photographed. He was released. No charges at all were filed against him. Colby was at work when Lori called him to tell him that Charles had died. She said he'd come over to pick up JJ and then had a heart attack and died right there. What timing? Colby was immediately concerned about his brother and sister. When he called his wife to tell her, Kelsey, he said that nothing about it felt right, like something was off. Colby went over to the house where he saw Alex sitting on the couch wearing a bandage around his head. Tylee was extremely upset, crying and hugging Colby. She told him that Alex and Charles had gotten into a fight that night or that day and Alex had shot him. So Friday, July 12th, the day after Charles died, Lori sent a group text to Charles's two adult sons. This is a full day later.
And a group text.
A group text. She says, "Hi, boys. I have very sad news. Your dad passed away yesterday. I'm working on making arrangements and I'll keep you informed with what's going on. I'm still not sure how to handle things. Just want you to know that I love you. And so did your dad." Heart emoji or whatever.
That's something that you text when you're like, "Hey, won't be able to make it to dinner."
Yeah. So obviously, Charles's sons are like, what
the fuck?
Yeah. So they're asking like, what happened? Like, where is he? Where are you guys? Are the kids okay?
Healthy, I would think 40, 50 something year old man.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. And it's just like, oh, well, he passed away. It's like, was it a heart attack? Was it a car accident? I mean, I'm sure they're probably thinking like car accident or something because like what else, you know? And then they keep texting her like, okay, now you're telling us that our dad died and you're just disappearing. And they kept saying like, you're not too busy to let us know. We need to know what happened. You need to get in contact with us. I don't care what you're doing. You need to contact us. So she replies back, "I'm sorry you are so upset. I'm upset too. I'm trying to get JJ ready for bed. I'm waiting to hear back from the medical examiner to make sense out of all of this myself. Please be patient with me. It's a crushing situation all the way around. I'm still trying to process it too and what it means for JJ." So Lori continued to evade their questions, still not explaining what happened to Charles. On July 15th, 4 days after Charles died, one of the boys sent a long text demanding answers from Lori. He also asked why she'd been the only one to contact them and why they hadn't heard from Colby or Tylee. He asked if JJ, the son, asked if JJ knew what had happened and if he was safe, along with wanting to know the details of what was happening with their father's remains. This, I feel like, is telling because Colby says as soon as he finds out that Charles is dead, he feels like something's off, but his questions are JJ and Tylee okay? Are they safe? And Charles's son immediately, in his subconscious, is flagged to ask the same thing. Is JJ safe? I just feel like, I think normally in a situation, if like somebody, you know, had passed away, I don't know that my first thought would be to ask, are the children that you are caring for safe? I might say something like,
are you okay?
Do you need help with them? Are you okay? You know, do you need, you know, stuff picked up, brought to you? Can I bring you guys dinner? Something like that. But their questions are is JJ safe?
Yeah, that is,
which I feel like is telling. I don't know.
Yeah.
Lori responded with a long text that explained how JJ believed that his father was in California working because, quote, he doesn't really understand. She said that she was putting up a memorial page on the funeral home's website and that Charles's wishes were to be cremated and have his children spread his ashes in Hawaii. She still did not offer any explanation as to what happened to Charles and continued to ignore their texts. On July 15th, Lori called Charles's insurance company to tell them that he died. Much to her surprise, she found that she was no longer the beneficiary of his $1 million life insurance policy. Charles had changed it a few months prior. Thank goodness.
Yes.
Thank goodness. She told Chad that he'd probably changed it after he'd been taken over by Ned. Must have been Ned. Damn it, Ned.
That's so Ned. Oh, geez. And that is the end of episode one.
Yep.
And we've got, this is a two-parter again. So
yeah,
either get it right away or next week.
Exactly. We'll pick it up in part two.
Yes. Thank you so much for hanging out with us. We love you.
Love you.
Bye.
Bye. All right, you guys, it's shout out time.
Shout out time.
Or, you know, we're going to fuck your name up time.
Yeah.
And that's a whoopsie, but, you know, we want to give a hey girl thanks to our newest patrons, Emily Duffield,
Tammy Jacobson,
Marcy Smith,
Tara Powers,
Kelly Lindsay,
Kimberly Rinesmith,
Tara May,
Tristan Williams,
Sarah,
Anaya Simmons.
This one says Bizballs with three Z's, so
not hey mad there, about Bizballs. That. Yeah, Bizballs. Aaliyah Slater,
Brooke Carter,
Nicole Noel,
Meg,
Sky,
Melissa Sanders,
Phoebe Smith,
Rachel Dubay,
Grace Hallam,
Michelle Mueller,
Corey Camigo,
Jessa,
Tanisha,
Emily Murray,
Alyssa Valente,
Olivia Martyr,
Chandler Otis,
Felicia McAlpine,
Kim Hartz,
Amanda Crampota,
Katie Drake,
Alicia Caitlin,
Kara Forney,
Allie Foster,
Millie Deb,
Stacy Bogle,
Brittany Reed,
Susan Viano,
Kirsten Gallagher,
Heaven Hamilton,
Kayla Walters,
Brittany Barrow,
Corinne Martin,
Abby Cost,
Nina Helixson,
Maddie Prosser,
Lindsay,
Elena Watt,
Benjamin Kayla Hayden,
Courtney Kipp,
Casey,
Mickey,
Amy Birch,
Morgan Nelson,
Mary Margaret Rosler,
Leah Jones,
Laurel Rickard,
Mary Broccoli. Oh my God, hey Mary! She's my neighbor!
Yay! Savannah Jones,
and Caitlin Tonelli. Thank you guys so much. We love you.
Oh, you guys are so amazing. Thank you so, so, so much.
Bye. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Connect with us on Instagram or Facebook to continue the conversation.
Thanks for listening, and we will meet you back here next week.
Bye.
The theme song for the show is created and composed by Stephen Toby. You can find more of Stephen's work on SoundCloud.
Our logo was created by Sloan Williams of Sophisticated Crayon. You can find more of her work on Etsy. Visit us at killerqueenspodcast.com for merch and other info about the show.